Good afternoon, please be seated. This next case is Fulbright and Jaworski et al. Versus District Court 65122. We are hearing oral argument on shortened notice concerning this writ. Are you ready to proceed?
I am, Your Honor.
Okay.
May it please the Court, my name is Matthew Lawley and I represent Fulbright and Jaworski and Jane Macon. The District Court unconstitutionally and unreasonably exercised jurisdiction over my clients, who are Texas lawyers that performed work in Texas applying Texas law regarding a Texas real estate project involving Texas tax incentives and a major Texas university, Texas A&M. This is a thoroughly Texas-centered case. The same district court judge, in fact, even ruled that Texas law applies. The question for this panel, therefore, is how do we get to personal jurisdiction over such a thoroughly Texas-centered case? I would like to explain that the trial court erred in two respects. One, the court incorrectly held my clients to personal jurisdiction simply for doing their job, for engaging in the normal incidents of an attorney-client relationship. And second, the court erred in finding evidence that two meetings that Jane Macon attended in Nevada somehow got over the bar of minimum contacts. Both of those were an error. Turning to the first point, the question could be stated whether personal jurisdiction can be established over an out-of-state attorney when that attorney engages in the normal incidents, mainly communications, not with a client in Nevada here, because Ms. Macon's client was actually a Texas entity during the course of that representation. The only people who were in Nevada were investors or constituents of Ms. Macon's client. Numerous courts throughout the country have held that a lawyer simply doing his or her job does not rise to the level of minimum contacts. Notably, the Federal District Court of Nevada in the Campbell case, Campbell versus Gaspar, said it this way, that where personal services are involved, such as with a doctor or a lawyer, the use of mails, telephone, those kinds of things do not amount to purposeful activity. That doesn't get you to the minimum contacts. Probably the most directly on point case, factually, and one whose reasoning is so compelling that this court could use its analysis to write the opinion in this matter, is the Ninth Circuit opinion of Scher versus Johnson. That was a case involving a Florida lawyer who was retained by a California client to provide legal representation in Florida. Identically to this case, it was argued when attempting to establish personal jurisdiction over the Florida lawyer in California that these normal incidents, things like phone calls, mails, sending bills, the fact that the bank payments, the bills were paid through California banks. And Judge Kaczynski, writing for the Ninth Circuit, said, referring to those as normal incidents of misrepresentation, they do not establish purposeful availment. This is not the deliberate creation of a substantial connection with California. Those are the identical facts that are alleged against my client and on which the district court found personal jurisdiction, specific jurisdiction. But the Scher case goes on, referring to the promotion of business. The court pointed out that the business of California was not being promoted, but to the direct contrary, it was the business of Florida, namely legal representation that was being promoted in Florida. It was also noted that the Florida lawyer did not come into California and solicit a client, but rather the California client went to Florida to find the lawyer. That's exactly what happened here. Authorized representatives of Verano Land Group, which again is a Texas limited partnership, went into Texas, identified Jane Macon and Phil Brighton Jaworski as the lawyer and law firm to assist them in this San Antonio, Texas project, and hired them there. We now get to one of the trial court's main errors, focusing on the trips. It is true that Jane Macon made three trips to Nevada. One was for personal. The others were to provide updates to her client's constituents, investors in the limited partners of the Texas limited partnership. Referring to similar trips made by the Florida lawyer into California, Justice Kaczynski also noticed that these trips were incident to the Florida representation. Noting the argument that that might establish minimum contacts, he immediately disagreed and said this: three trips to California were discrete events arising out of a case centered entirely in Florida. They appear to have been little more than a convenience to the client who would otherwise have had to travel to Florida.
Tell us a little more about the meetings. What were the first meeting and the second meeting? Not interested in the personal.
I'm moving to that point now. Because you're right, that's what the trial court focused on. And in fact, in both the trial court transcript and in her order, she noted that at these meetings there was legal advice provided. As this court knows, in order to establish a prima facie case for personal jurisdiction, you must have competent evidence of minimum contacts. There must actually be evidence to establish that. And here, and this is the heart of the error, is that there was none. The only evidence we have about what happened in those two meetings is one declaration from a gentleman named Steve Schneider, who was not Jane Macon's client. He was an investor in some of the limited partnerships. And he attended these meetings, and in his declaration, which can be found at the appellate record, page 157, he said he attended two meetings at Las Vegas. They were attended by Jane Macon as well. He had personal knowledge of that. He saw her. He then says that she held herself out at those meetings as the attorney for Verano Land Group. That's a conclusion. It's not a statement of fact. It's a conclusion. We don't know what she did or what she said to hold her out. There's no competent evidence of that. Mr. Schneider goes on to say that in addition, as part of the presentation, and along with two other people, Ralph Lampman and Tom Losey, who were two of the three authorized representatives of Verano Land Group, Mr. Schneider says that Macon asked for additional capital infusions. That is the sum total of the evidence of what happened in these two meetings. Notably missing from that is, number one, any identification of legal advice that was provided, no identification of such legal advice being material or having been relied on. There's nothing about the legal advice. And perhaps more importantly, what is lacking here is evidence of the second part of the purposeful availment test, which is you have to show competent evidence that something that happened in that meeting forms the basis of one of Verano Land Group's claims against Phil Brighton Jaworski and Jane Macon. There is nothing. Now, it's important that we focus on competent evidence because I have described what evidence existed. That is the sum and substance of the evidence about what happened in those meetings. The trial court erroneously concluded that legal advice was provided. There is no evidence of legal advice.
Counsel, we're trying to get caught up on the pleadings here. We're moving the case rather quickly. Could you give us a chronology? Was the meeting after the limited partnership became a Nevada limited partnership?
No, no. The chronology is this. The meetings in the fall of 2010, the general partners of Verano Land Group are removed by a vote of the supermajority. At that time, three individuals, Mr. Wharton, McGarry, and DeSimone, now become the authorized representatives of the general partnership. That's the fall of 2010. Just prior to that are these meetings, August of 2010. So you've got August 2010, and then it's September or October of 2010 where the partnership change occurs. If you look at page 7 of Verano's opposition memorandum to our initial petition, or not our petition, but our motion to dismiss for lack of personal jurisdiction, you'll see that they lay out the chronology. The next thing that happens is there, Mr. Wharton, Mr. McGarry, and Mr. DeSimone's representatives of Verano have some additional interaction with Jane Macon throughout early and into their words, mid-2011. Fulbright and Jaworski.
Not in Nevada, though.
Not in Nevada. Well, they say they have phone calls with them going back. They're in Nevada. She's in Texas.
Got it.
And then in September of 2011, Fulbright sends a letter saying that the representation is terminated. It's then in November of 2011 that the limited partnership is changed from a Texas limited partnership to a Nevada, after Fulbright has terminated its representation and ceased performing legal services. And then 2 months later, this lawsuit is filed.
Is there any evidence in the record showing any investment by any investor subsequent to the Macon meetings?
There is no evidence in the record of any subsequent investment that I have seen. I would like to leave a few minutes for rebuttal if that's acceptable to the court. I'd like to address any questions that you may have prior to that if you have.
You have 3 minutes.
Thank you.
Okay, Mr. Jones.
Thank you, Justice Hartsey. May it please the court, the first thing I would have to say is that the respondents have a completely different understanding of the facts of this case. And I would like to start out by saying that it is with some hesitancy that my clients brought suit against their counsel. We understand this is a very prestigious, important law firm in Texas. But we have a situation here where these some 230 Nevada residents invested over $65 million in a Texas real estate deal. And to hear the Fulbright counsel speak about it, there's almost nothing they did outside of Texas. And in terms of both general jurisdiction and specific jurisdiction, the record is replete with information and evidence that contradicts the idea that there was a couple of meetings here, that there were no legal advice was given, that were essentially almost as if this was a coincidental visit by this partner who was overseeing this case. Let me start by saying counsel relies heavily on the Scherer case, which he admits is a Ninth Circuit case. Since Scherer, we have had, this court has decided Trump, which applies to this fact circumstance, Pacoli, which applies to this circumstance. That Trump was in 93, Pacoli was in 95. And then we have the Daimler bombing case in the U.S. Supreme Court, which I have some familiarity with because as a result of that case, you all decided the Vega case where I was counsel in Vega. And I was actually on the other side, the losing side of that case.
Mr. Jones, before you get into that legal discussion, give us your context of facts that we should hang our hat in to accept that legal analysis that you're about to go into. Because his position is we don't have those contacts. Obviously, yours is we do, so I'd like to have the facts.
And I'm glad you asked me that question because that was certainly something I wanted to discuss with the court today. Let's start at the beginning. We have all of these Nevada residents. They have a general partner at the time that has a managing member called Triple L. That's a Nevada LLC. The only fee agreement that exists in this case, the only written fee agreement that exists in this case, is between Fulbright Jaworski and Triple L Management LLC, a Nevada limited liability company with its address in the state of Nevada. So the relationship between the parties started from that document, which, by the way, was sent to the Nevada address. So from the inception, the Fulbright Jaworski knew they were dealing with a Nevada party. They knew the investors were from Nevada. And that leads me to Bacoli. 1995, a Colorado real estate transaction where a Colorado developer was dealing with people here in Nevada, Bacoli's. And this court held, and I'd like to just quote part of this, it is not necessary for a defendant to physically enter the forum. Use of the telephone can be sufficient for purposeful availment. So in that case, this court found a real estate transaction where everything was related primarily to Colorado, that the defendant in that case purposely availed themselves of their of coming into the state to do business. So what else did Fulbright Jaworski do? They sent 74 invoices for something over $3.5 million worth of fees charged to Nevada clients. By the way, of the 241 investors, 233, all but eight, are from Nevada. So this state where the injury is going to occur in this situation is in Nevada. And so we have the invoices sent to Nevada address. We have payment through a Nevada bank. We have telephone calls. We have contracts written between multiple entities. And that's just specific jurisdiction. I'd like to talk a little bit about general jurisdiction, which Mr. Lally did not speak to. This is a law firm, and I would pose a question to this court. Is Greenberg Troy, does it not have its home? Could it not consider its home to be in Nevada as well? That's a Miami, Florida law firm. Now, I understand there's a difference there because they have an office here and they have employees. But in this particular case, we have Fulbright coming here and doing all kinds of business, not just this case, not just cohocking in on one case. Or in fact, they went to the legislature and lobbied Mr. Les LeBeau in two different legislative sessions, the 74th and the 75th, came into the state for the purpose of lobbying our legislature.
Is there anything in the record, any declaration, affidavit, or otherwise, that shows that those two instances of lobbying had anything to do with the business affairs of the LLC?
Of my client?
Yep.
They did not, Your Honor. Now, I'm talking about general jurisdiction. I'm not talking about Jane Macon, just so it's clear to the court. I'm talking about the breadth of the type of work that this law firm did in the state. This is not a situation where they came in to take a couple of depositions. They've been here for over 10 years. As Mr. Carter pointed out to me, they've been practicing law in some of the most complex, large-scale litigation in this state, including presently, longer than he's practiced law, since 2004. They've been involved in civil litigation that's had two jury trials and two appeals. They've been involved in the Actos litigation just recently, last year, a four-month jury trial. They've been lobbying here. They put on their website the Suen case. They have told people out there in the ether, on the Internet, by the way, we are a big law firm. We do business in Nevada. We were a counsel in the Suen litigation in Nevada. That is purposely availing themselves of the opportunity to do business in this state. And they should not be allowed to ignore that circumstance and shield themselves from liability in this particular case. With respect to specific jurisdiction, in addition to the invoicing, the $3 million in fees that they've been paid by Nevada residents through Nevada banks, the contracts that they have prepared for multiple different Nevada entities that they have sent into the state of Nevada to these companies that they created in Texas but have Nevada addresses. And then I'd like to address this point about coming up here twice. Mr. Lawley talks about the fact that there's no competent evidence. Well, I have a disagreement with him as to his definition of competent evidence. We have a finding by the trial court, which we all know is the trial court is the finder of fact. The trial court heard the evidence. We know, and by the way, the allegation in this complaint that this law firm went, and in particular one partner, and we don't know why she did it, but the allegation is, and the evidence supports this proposition, the depositions, the testimony of, in fact, three general partners who are here in this courtroom today, Mr. Workman, Mr. McGarry, and Mr. DeSimone, all have testified in deposition about how Jane Macon came in and took over this project, essentially became, for all intents and purposes, a partner. And it is our contention, it is the allegation in this complaint, that Ms. Macon came up here with the former general partners to help solicit the funds for an additional capital call, in part, so they could keep getting paid. And you ask a question, Justice Hardesty, is when did, well, were they at Nevada entity by that point in time? That's a very interesting question. The evidence shows, as through the testimony of the three general partners, that's when they started looking into this issue. That's when they became suspicious, and that's why they didn't put any additional capital money into this project and took it away from the former general partners. They started asking questions. They started asking Jane Macon at Fulbright, what's going on? Why don't we know about the fact that a $253 million public tax incremental contract was given to this third party that is owned 100% by the three former general partners instead of going to the benefit of the partnership? Why weren't we told about that? She came up here. In fact, Mr. McGarry had the good sense to record that meeting. So in one of those two meetings, we actually had Ms. Macon's voice on the tape. So that is, in my opinion, well, that is, I believe, to be competent evidence of what was done at that meeting.
Is that tape in this record before us?
The tape, well, Your Honor, and that's a difficult question. And the reason I say that is because there's been ongoing discovery, as you know. So when the writ was filed, I don't recall if that tape, in fact, as I think about it, I think that tape was produced after the writ was filed. But that's the problem when we have a writ. It's an ongoing process, and we were doing discovery up until weeks ago, literally. Many of those depositions relate specifically to the jurisdiction issue in this case. So if I could make a couple of points. One thing that I think is important to point out.
Would you agree with your opponent, though, that no money was invested after the two Macon visits to Nevada?
No new money was invested in the partnership, to my knowledge. I believe additional attorney's fees were, in fact, paid after that time period, that after those meetings occurred, mm-hmm. were paid to Fulbright Jaworski. Mm-hmm. But the point is, with respect to those meetings, it is our contention and the allegations in the complaint that Fulbright Jaworski, in particular through the person of Jane Macon, the partner in charge of this file, that's not a contested fact in this case, was essentially in a conspiracy or helping facilitate these other general partners to defraud the partnership. And again, we have a situation here where Fulbright Jaworski has specifically come into the state, spoken to the investors about their investment, about what was going on in Texas, has withheld information, for instance, this entity VTLM that Fulbright Jaworski created for the former general partners, which we believe resulted in a defrauding of an asset worth approximately $250 million. And when Ms., which is, I believe, in the record, Mr. McGarry specifically sent emails and asked, what is this entity after months and months of asking questions like this, was finally told by Jane Macon, oh, we created that as part of this deal, without disclosing the full implications of that relationship and what it meant to the partnership. So, in summary, if you look at Trump or the Vega case, and I'm quoting here Trump, where the defendant purposely establishes contact with the forum state and affirmatively directs conduct toward the forum state, and the cause of action arises from that purposeful contact with the forum or conduct targeting the forum, there is jurisdiction. And that's specific jurisdiction, and that defines this case in a nutshell. That's what has happened in this case. The appellant can talk about competent evidence all they want. That's the evidence that we believe is in the record. We believe that's the evidence that Judge Alf relied upon in finding jurisdiction, both general and specific. But under no circumstances could it be said that there's not specific jurisdiction in this case based upon the long history of the jurisprudence in this state that I've already referenced. And I'm not talking about what some other states have done in some other circumstances. I'm talking about McCauley, Trump, Vega, all say these contacts are sufficient to confer jurisdiction. And in fact, if you look at those cases, compared to what we have in this situation, we have much greater evidence than was found to confer jurisdiction in those in the McCauley case. Your Honors, we believe that...
I think you might be overreading Viega. Viega was a specific jurisdiction case, and we sent her back for further discovery. So,
and Your Honor, I guess what I would say with respect to Viega is that it set forth the test, as I understood it, and I believe that certainly...
Probably Judge Alf applied that test here for specific jurisdiction.
That case was certainly before her. Oh, Your Honors, I apologize. I misspoke. I thought there was not the evidence. It came out actually in the deposition. Mr. McGarry put in an additional $1 million in investment after the meetings with Ms. Macon. So I misspoke, and I apologize for that.
Do you have a record cite on that?
I don't have it. I just handed that information.
Okay. Perhaps you could supply that to the clerk when arguments concluded here.
I would be happy to do that, Your Honor.
Great. Thanks.
If the court has any additional...
We're only on the expedited trial. I think you wanted to go ahead with that trial in January. Is it still a firm date, or where are you with that?
Since it's been stayed, I think it's probably an impossibility to have that trial at this point in time, but certainly depending on the outcome of this writ, we would ask the court again for a trial date. There was and certainly this is a part of the record, there was a race to the courthouse after we filed. There was a case filed in Texas, and there was an issue as to who was going to go first, and Judge Alf granted that expedited trial based in part on that issue.
Where are the parties as far as discovery is concerned? How long?
Discovery is closed, Your Honor.
It's over.
Discovery is closed. The expert witnesses, so I think there's one witness. There's one expert witness that has to be deposed. I think that's it. That was agreed upon after the discovery deadline, actually, but then the stay was put in place.
Is there any more discovery needed on jurisdiction on that issue by either side?
Well, that's an interesting question, Your Honor, because after the writ was filed, there was no supplements on jurisdiction that I recall were filed with the court, even though a great deal of discovery occurred that relates to jurisdiction. So certainly the record could be supplemented based upon a wealth of discovery that occurred or transpired from the time the writ petition was fully briefed until now, because we did continue to do discovery.
Okay.
Thank you.
In response to Justice Douglas's question about what evidence is there of contacts, Mr. Jones has made my case. Mr. Jones responds that there are Nevada residents.
Well, what about McGarry's investment of over $1 million after this?
McGarry's investment of $1 million, number one, that's not in the record. And number two, I don't remember the timing of that, but that was after Fulbright and Jaworski ceased representing Verona Land Group. So we've got what the contacts that are established in the record and that were before the trials court are, you have Nevada residents who are not the client, but who are constituents of the client. You have correspondence, including an engagement agreement. You have invoices, and you have bills being paid. Those are precisely the types of things that not merely the Scherr case, but certainly the Scherr case, have said are the mere incidents of the attorney-client relationship that are not enough to get you over the minimum contacts.
Do you deny the thoughts about all the business that the firm's been conducting in this state?
For purposes of general jurisdiction, there is evidence of a couple of pro hoc vice applications and appearances, and there's the lobbying, which was in two different years by one person. Okay? That is not something that is sufficient to establish continuous and systematic contacts. It's not something that gets you to the point of approximating physical presence. The very fact that he pointed out about Greenberg Trowick having an office in Nevada, that's exactly the same kinds of things that Nevada looks at. I point you to the Proskauer case from the Nevada Federal District Court. Proskauer was in New York. It had a Nevada client. It even provided an opinion to the Nevada client, and still, that was not enough. There was not enough to approximate. There's a very high standard for general jurisdiction, and you can't meet it. They can find no cases where you meet general jurisdiction on the scant record that we have here. And what's more, that wouldn't apply to Jane Macon in any event. But going back to specific jurisdiction, what we don't have is what they had in the Scherr case. Because in the Scherr case, the individual lawyers were not subject to jurisdiction in California, but the firm was, because the firm reached out to California, took a lien on the client's California property to secure repayment. That didn't happen here. That extra thing that is not incidental to the attorney-client relationship is what is lacking, and that is why there's no specific jurisdiction.
Okay, any other questions for counsel? Since some of your clients are here, I want to speak to them directly about the processing of this case. When we received some of the emergency motions, the subject matter of this writ came to the attention of this panel. But the writ, as you all know, was filed back last March. And all I can say is we didn't know that. The Supreme Court of Nevada is an extraordinarily busy court with one of the heaviest workloads in the country. And this writ proceeding simply was not brought to our attention until the first order entered to stay the trial. So we're trying to play catch-up. We ordered this argument on very short notice because we recognize that all of you have been working on the case for much longer than we have. And all I can do on behalf of the court is apologize for the delay that it has taken us to address your matter. And I wish we'd have been able to do it sooner. You have no idea how frustrating it is to these three judges in particular and to our colleagues to have these kinds of situations develop. And we will do our best to decide this matter as quickly as we can. It stands submitted. We thank you for your patience.